Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are in a world of hurt, ladies and gentlemen. If you've been watching this show at all, you know that to be so. I fear that it may get worse before it gets better, especially if we don't have better leadership at the moment and in the months to come. They're very fraught, and I'm fearful that enemies, foreign and domestic, have taken stock of the current parlous state of our leadership with an eye to exploiting it, and to our great detriment as well as their benefit. We never fail to have an interesting conversation about such topics with our first guest, but it could hardly be more timely today to discuss them with our friend Charles Sam Faddis. He has distinguished himself with public service of various kinds, including service in the United States Army, as well as an undercover operative in the Central Intelligence Agency. Arguably among his most important service contributions, I think, is the one he's rendering these days. Now, out of government, running a terrific online resource and magazine at Substack.com. He's the author of a number of books, fiction and nonfiction, including Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Sam Faddis, it's great to have you with us always, but especially at a time such as this. Welcome, sir.
As always, great to be here, Frank. I wish we did not have so many bad things to talk about.
Me too. But I think it's the beginning of knowledge, which is the beginning of corrective action. So we appreciate your time in these regards always. I want to start, I'm not sure we've ever talked specifically about your best professional judgment about something that has been in the offing for as long as I can remember, sometimes a few years off, sometimes a year or so off, sometimes a month, sometimes down to days off, and that would be the acquisition, at long last, by the mullahs in Tehran, of the ultimate weapon of mass destruction, hydrogen bombs, perhaps, certainly atomic weapons. What is your assessment, Sam, as to whether they now actually have those weapons in hand?
I think that realistically, we have to now operate under the assumption that they have functioning nuclear weapons. We've gone through the phase of one analytical body after another saying things like they're within 7 months or they're within 6 weeks, or the last one I read a couple of weeks ago was they're within 3 days. I mean, first of all, let's just be real. We don't have the intelligence to make that judgment with that degree of precision, right? As you well know, okay, that if they're within 3 days, they have the bomb. The engineering work, assembling the device, in other words, the mechanics of what makes the uranium, say, go boom, they completed a long time ago. It's been well established that they have done cold tests. In other words, they tested this thing without actually making it go off, so it works. The delivery vehicles have existed for a long time. The missiles, the things you can put this in. It was reported many, many years ago that, for instance, they just happened to have designed ICBMs. And if you look at the nose cone, the capsule, what it actually delivers, amazingly enough, the payload and the dimensions just seem to match perfectly with the known dimensions of a Chinese device that they are known to have the specs for. I don't think that's an accident. So, you know, the only thing that
when you say they have the specs for, Sam, does that mean the design plan? And therefore, if they simply have the other, you know, wherewithal, the enriching of uranium, a key element of it, but also machining and, you know, otherwise shaping these things into warheads, they can do it based on that plan?
Without question. And that's exactly what I mean. They have the blueprints. And keep in mind, that when the Russians stole the blueprints from us, from the Manhattan Project back in the 40s, within a few years, they went from nothing to having a functional bomb, which, as I've said many times, was effectively our bomb. I mean, if we had outsourced to the Russians the construction of our weapons, it would have looked the same. So look, they have, you just walk through all of this, the wiring harnesses, which are these sophisticated electronic harnesses you need to make sure the bomb detonates with precision, if you will. They were acquiring those many, many, many years ago. So you
can
are
I ask you about one other aspect of the sim without hopefully interrupting your train of thought?
Yeah.
Another facet, I think it's fair to say, of the Iranian nuclear weapons program is that they haven't had to do it without external help beyond those plans. I mean, for example, talk about the connection between the Iranian nuclear program and that of North Korea, for example.
100%. They have complete interaction with the North Koreans, share information, and if you bring up the case of North Korea, let's think about it. Okay, this is the ultimate pariah state, impoverished, famine, everything else. Well, okay, these guys have acquired and detonated on multiple occasions nuclear weapons. So we're
and build a lot of them. And they've actually, as I understand it, collaborated in the testing of some weapons with Iranians present as well. Is that your understanding?
And North Korean and Iranian personnel go back and forth all the time. This is not like one day, one time they met secretly. No, this is ongoing cooperation. The North Koreans have progressed to the point where they're perilously close to being either perilously close to or already can launch nuclear weapons on missiles from submarines submerged in the Pacific Ocean. That's how far down the road they are. So, I mean, you know,
with the range, in some cases, their missiles can actually get to us here in the United States, right?
The whole intent is they can already hit Japan, so they're not putting missiles on subs to hit Tokyo. They're putting missiles on subs so they can get them close enough to our shores to hit American cities. So the Biden administration is obviously not going to be transparent about where the Iranians are, but anybody who's paying attention has to say, at this point, Iran is now a nuclear-armed power, with all the implications.
And they're huge. Among them, Sam, is the fact that, as you know so well, you, in your last duty station at the Langley headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency, were responsible for contending with weapons of mass destruction terrorism, which, of course, nuclear is a very important component. Talk a bit about the relationship between Iran and a group that we are told is here in some numbers and certainly has access to the country at will, given the destruction of our southern border and pretty porous northern one, for that matter, by Joe Biden, namely a designated terrorist group called Hezbollah.
Well, like Hezbollah is effectively, it is a proxy for the Iranians. They work hand in glove. Hezbollah works worldwide. They move drugs. They move everything. Our southern border doesn't exist. Hezbollah has a base in Venezuela. Hezbollah is operating in American cities. We know that. Okay, so add all of this stuff together.
When you say operating, these are secret cells that could be activated on command from Tehran?
Yes, absolutely.
Could they also perhaps be, and I have to ask you to just take this question aboard, we'll answer it on the other side of a short break, but could Hezbollah's cells in the United States have access to a nuclear weapon if their masters in Tehran have such access? We're going to ask that question be answered on the other side of this very short break by the great Sam Faddis. I hope you'll stay tuned for the answer and more. Be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Meet your new doctor. His name is Tedros Ghebreyesus. If you like your present physician or simply don't want someone without an MD making critical decisions about how your personal health is managed, brace yourself. In just 12 short weeks, a Marxist bureaucrat from Ethiopia selected by the Chinese Communists to run the World Health Organization will be empowered to dictate what medicines you can use to treat any conditions he deems to be public health emergencies. Dr. Tedros had only advisory authority during COVID-19. His advice proved disastrously bad. Now the Biden administration is stealthily working to give the WHO's director general the authority to compel you to obey his prescriptions. If we don't stop them before May 27th, all of us will be surrendering our personal medical freedom and national sovereignty to Dr. Tedros. Hate that prospect? Say no at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Sam Faddis is in the house virtually. We're always pleased to be able to say he's somewhere in the mix, and especially as I've just put to him a very, very portentous question, which is if the mullahs in Tehran have indeed, as he believes is the case, gotten their hands not just on all the relevant technology and the enriched uranium, but the manufactured nuclear weapons that are suited to be placed, well, presumably on, among other delivery vehicles, long-range ballistic missiles. But also, is it possible that they could be delivered by their proxies, the terrorist group known as Hezbollah? And Sam, what are your thoughts on that possibility?
Well, anytime you're talking about nuclear weapons, as you just indicated, you talk about delivery vehicle, right? That's the terminology, right? Okay, in our terms, we're going to put it on a missile, we're going to hang it on a jet aircraft, whatever, that's what we're going to do. Okay, how about Hezbollah as a delivery vehicle? They work hand in glove with the Iranians. They are all over the Western Hemisphere, documented extensively. They're not just in the United States, but in here long term, planning, casing targets, etc. We have no border. There is no reason on earth that the Iranians cannot move a nuclear weapon into the United States, for that matter, multiples. Look, without getting into anything remotely classified, an American nuclear warhead that's 10 times the power of Hiroshima measures roughly 30 inches in length and a little under a foot in diameter, and it weighs a couple of hundred pounds. Now, when you have an organization like Hezbollah, and you have no border, and fentanyl floods in here, and everything else floods in here, and millions of people walk across our border, and you can put that thing in the trunk of a subcompact automobile, I mean, come on. Anybody who wanted to say to you that's impossible, That's absurd. They could honestly do it anytime they want. They could have already done it.
This is the crux of the matter, is this could have happened. The emplacement in the hands of people who are trained to murder. I believe it's actually God's will, their God, Allah, its will, to murder as many of us as possible. And Sam, I think in this context, we must say, for over 40 years, since with Jimmy Carter's considerable help, the Ayatollahs took over in Iran, right, their daily mantra has not simply been death to Israel, but death to America. And I think they are deadly serious about executing on that commitment. Which brings me to the border situation. You've mentioned that it is porous. You've mentioned that fentanyl comes across it. We've talked on many occasions that personnel, including some that we're particularly concerned about, namely Chinese military personnel, are coming here in large numbers. And I guess you've alluded to this, but just to put a fine point on it, if they don't have a nuclear weapon in this country at the moment, would there really be any significant impediment to them getting it in here, either across now open borders or by ship or through FedEx, for all we know.
No, look, back when I was running the unit focused on terrorist weapons of mass destruction and would sit in meetings in Washington, D.C., where we talk about the possibility of this happening, this is a number of years ago, my honest response even then, under administrations that were at least attempting on some level to control the border, which that went away along as soon as Joe sat down via the office, was to say, listen, if you are under some illusion that we have defenses that will protect a nuclear weapon as of the dimensions I was talking about earlier, you talk about a pretty small thing moving across that border, you're going to have to be extraordinarily lucky to do that. Everybody thinks this throws off some gigantic radioactive signature and you can detect it from zillions of miles away. I mean, that's not the way these things work. As you know, they're shielded and so forth. They're shielded. Uranium is not, relatively speaking, highly radioactive in the sense of cesium or something that kills you as soon as you're in proximity to it. No, it's a lot harder than that. These days, no. And look, if you were the Iranians and you acquired nuclear weapons, would you tell everybody about it and then try to figure out how to get it to the United States or emplace it? No, I don't think so. There are a lot of things. Stupid is not one of them.
Yeah. Sam, finally, Adam Credo at the Washington Free Beacon has just reported on a breaking news item that is very much relevant to what we've just been discussing. And its title is Biden, quote, abused the classification system, unquote, to hide Iranian assassination plots from Congress and the public. And I believe he was keying off of some statements that Senator Ted Cruz made in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee this week to that effect. And we know that at least two former senior officials in the Trump administration, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, have been warned that they're on that target list for assassination. I'm told, I think there was a recent report that some $12 million has been spent in just the past few months trying to protect these guys against this sort of threat, presumably from Hezbollah or maybe the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps or Quds Force or some other element of the mullah's capacity here. Talk about the fact that, A, this is a possibility, assassinations in our own country at the hands of the Iranians or their proxies, and B, that the Biden administration might be concealing information about that from Congress as well as the public.
Well, it's a fact that the Iranians have the capacity to reach out and touch people in this country. They, of course, have ever since the revolution tracked down and killed people all over the globe, including Western Europe, on many, many occasions. So that's fact. And as you noted, Secret Service has admitted that they've spent $12 million just trying to protect two targets against them. So that would give you an idea of the magnitude of the threat they think they're dealing with. In terms of the Biden,
and how difficult it is to protect against determined people trying to kill them.
Look, again, you're not, when we talk about Hezbollah, Quds Force, the Iranians, you are not talking about a couple of guys who got radicalized watching a YouTube video yesterday and now have a cool idea to go kill somebody. We talk about guys that have been trained for many, many years, working in a structure where they plan in advance. I mean, this is the varsity team, and you better be prepared for that. In terms of the Biden administration covering it up, without question, I mean, look, there's a presidential daily brief, as you know, that goes out every day. Okay. Analysts are supposed to be able to submit items to that with integrity and with a large degree of independence to it's not just to the president, but to other senior policymakers. It has been the case for some time under the Biden administration that the head of the CIA and the director of national intelligence scrub what items are allowed to go forward for political purposes. So analysts look at the intelligence, they write pieces, they want to send them out to senior policymakers. And then, Avril Haines steps in and says, well, that's not in keeping with our political agenda. And she buries it. The intelligence is not dissimilar. So that's reality.
This is chilling stuff. We have to leave it at that for the moment. We will be back to you for more, needless to say. Thank you for your past service to our country and that you're rendering these days at End Magazine at Substack.com. Keep it up, and we'll talk with you soon. God bless you. Be right back with more, folks. Stay tuned.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Right now?
Sure.
Okay. We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a friend and much admired colleague, a man I've been privileged to know and work with for, I think, the better part of 20 years now. When he was actually an FBI agent, I think, is when our paths first crossed, he was doing training for his colleagues about a threat that the Bush administration, I'm sorry to report, and subsequently the Obama administration, and subsequently, to some extent, the Trump administration, and certainly the Biden administration, don't want FBI agents or, frankly, the rest of us to know much about. And that is the Muslim Brotherhood, its presence in our country, its infrastructure here, which is vast, as well as its intent to help bring about the Sharia supremacist agenda of, a caliphate in which we do not feature. His name is John Guandolo. He has since left the FBI. He was a Naval Academy grad. He was a Force Reconnaissance Marine before joining the FBI, and he's been in the fight in a variety of capacities ever since. These days, he is a national security consultant and a man that we consider one of our most valuable resources. John, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Thank you for having me again, Frank. I appreciate it.
I was thinking of you in particular, John, because earlier this week, uncommitted voters cast their ballots against Joe Biden in the state of Michigan. And this was something that got actually 13% of the primary voters in that state, Democrats, of course. And I just was wondering about the provenance of this campaign. It seems as though the MB, as it's come to be known, the Muslim Brotherhood, was in the mix. Obviously, there were others as well, but give us your analysis of what happened there and what it suggests about what's going on more broadly.
Yes, well, I think this is one in a long line of operations between the U.S. Islamic movement and the communist movement and people that collaborate with them. And so I think for listeners, I think the one thing that this discussion needs as an emphasis, at least from me, is the level of coordination that takes place between these two movements here in the United States is and has been for a long time very significant. That's the intentionality of it, the level of coordination between both sides. And again, I'm talking about the communist movement, the Islamic movement. It's significant. And as you know, I have a significant intelligence network here in the United States that I rely on to give me both ground truth as well as what these elements are doing at the national level. And we see it. And it's why we're able to predict a lot of the efforts that they're doing, because they telegraph them. If you understand how they coordinate and how they communicate with each other. So this is just another line, because as you've actually spoken about, and some in the media are starting to understand, there is at least a probability, I would say a significant one, that the Democrats are going to try to put someone in the mix. And even if they don't, and they let this thing go through the machinations of the next election, they have a plan to retain power, and they are not going to give up the power. And I think they will do anything they can to maintain that power.
Gosh, there's a lot to unpack there, John. Let me try to just make an overall point and then ask you to sort of tease a little bit of that out. I appeared briefly due to technical difficulties on Steve Bannon's War Room show earlier this week to talk a little bit about, well, essentially this proposition that what we're watching in Michigan, yes, but elsewhere as well, in the context of a pro-Hamas effort, yes, but also more broadly, is indeed the red-green axis at work, as it's been called, and that the jihadis and their infrastructure, and by the way, it's not just the Sunnis, as you know, John, it's the Shia of Iran and their Hezbollah and other fronts that are also in the mix here. But to the extent that that is a thing, I just wanted to respond to Media Matters, which makes a full-time job of critiquing Steve Bannon's program, as best I can tell. They headlined a piece by saying, Steve Bannon revives ancient right-wing talking point about an imaginary alliance between liberal voters and radical Islamists. I take it you regard this as not an ancient right-wing talking point, but a real and present danger in our country, and that it may not be confined to the efforts to support Hamas on the one hand, or for that matter, to make common cause in a peaceable manner. Is that a correct understanding of where you see this as it is now and where it's likely to go?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's important to make a couple points. Number one, for your audience, Hamas is a designated terrorist group, and it is an inherent part of the Muslim Brotherhood, both at the international level and the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood. It is an inherent part of who they are.
So, as I understand it, it's really the Palestinian franchise of the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that the case?
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. On the other side, and there still seems to be a disconnect here with even some conservative voters, what I would call, you know, conservative patriot voters, is, you know, groups like Black Lives Matter, that was born out of the largest Chinese communist group in the United States. Antifa is what I use the phrase, it's a Soviet era communist group, which is true. And they still operate under those guidelines. So let's talk about that. Let's just take this Media Matters talking point and blow it out of the water. So we have ISIS and Al-Qaeda, or Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, from declassified FBI reports, working directly with Antifa and Black Lives Matter, traveling overseas and having meetings with Al-Qaeda leaders and others. We have them working on U.S. college campuses together, and that's documented in FBI reports. You have the leader of Hamas in the United States, Nihad Awad, publicly saying 8 years ago, almost now. You know, Black Lives Matter, you reported heavily on this at the time. Black Lives Matter is our matter. Their campaign is our campaign. So, and then we see at the ground level, groups like the Muslim Students Association, Islamic Circle in North America, Islamic Society in North America, Hamas doing business as the Council on American Islamic Relations, and others.
Students for Justice in Palestine, would that be in the mix?
That's right. AMP, SJP, all these groups working directly with these communist groups. And it's not just BLM and Antifa. It's Communist Party USA. It's Democratic Socialists of America. It's Code Pink. It's ANSWER. I mean, the list goes on. So we see it, excuse me, at the international level, you have Communist China entering into a strategic partnership with the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's now been 4 years ago or more. And now you've got all the right down to the local level in Europe and the United States, these groups are working together.
You know, this is such an important overview, John, and informed by your own personal experience in the Bureau doing counterterrorism operations, as well as all that you've done since. But as you say, it's documented in, among other things, FBI papers. And I so appreciate your being an authoritative rendering of all of this to bear when we're being, as we have been basically, well, not just since 9/11, but especially since 9/11, lied to repeatedly about who we're up against, what they're motivated by, what they seek to accomplish, and the stealthy kind of jihad that they're engaged in, not just the violent or pre-violent kind. So, John, when you take stock of all of this, are you anticipating that in the course of this very, very fraught year, we may well see these groups, and I would just add into the mix the possibility that there will be very direct foreign involvement as well. You mentioned Communist China. We could add in Turkey and Qatar, prime backers of the Muslim Brotherhood, to say nothing of Iran, of course, that this moves from, you know, demonstrations on college campuses, demonstrations in the streets, you know, action in the polling booth, into a much more aggressive and very likely violent phase as well.
Absolutely. They are not going to surrender power. And I truly believe they are going to do anything and everything to maintain that power. And the as you well
and know, and you're saying basically they are in power now in the
absolutely
form of the Biden administration.
Absolutely, they are. And it's interesting because people I talk with still have a hard time grasping the fact of the level of control these enemies of liberty, this cabal, you know, the Islamic movement, the communist movement, the people collaborating with them that may not be ideologically aligned, but still advancing their cause, people financing them. This cabal is very much controlling the key components of our federal government and many has significant influence in many state governments. Absolutely.
John, where do people find more of your work and where to get in touch?
Well, johnguandolo.com is the best way to reach me, and I look forward to folks who want to discuss the solutions.
Wonderful. Raising a Jihadi Generation is your book. Get in touch with John at johnguandolo.com. God bless you. Come back, sir. It's very soon, if you would. We'll be right back, folks. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Meet your new doctor. His name is Tedros Ghebreyesus. If you like your present physician or simply don't want someone without an MD making critical decisions about how your personal health is managed,
Brace yourself. In just 12 short weeks, a Marxist bureaucrat from Ethiopia selected by the Chinese communists to run the World Health Organization will be empowered to dictate what medicines you can use to treat any conditions he deems to be public health emergencies. Dr. Tedros had only advisory authority during COVID-19. His advice proved disastrously bad. Now the Biden administration is stealthily working to give the WHO's director general the authority to compel you to obey his prescriptions. If we don't stop them before May 27th, all of us will be surrendering our personal medical freedom and national sovereignty to Dr. Tedros. Hate that prospect? Say no at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. This is a very special moment in the course of our week's programming, and that is the D.D. Laugesen segment. We're always delighted to have my friend and colleague D.D. Laugesen. She's a woman of many parts. We treasure her help with the job of the Executive Secretary of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. She is an incredibly important cat herder with our Sovereignty Coalition and many others that we are engaged in as well. But not least, she is the executive director of a terrific organization. We call it the Save the Persecuted Christians. And I'm proud to be its president, but the heavy lifting is done by Dee Dee faithfully. And she is now a featured guest on this show to talk a little bit each week about what is going on with the, well, unimaginably horrific persecution that is taking place of Christians for reasons basically that come down to the fact that they follow Jesus Christ. And there are now, according to our friends at Open Doors USA, some 360 million of them worldwide, more than every man, woman, and child in America. It's an abomination, and it must be stopped. And we're going to visit with Dee Dee about a rather important development, albeit misplaced at the moment, but that may be bearing, if we do our work and get your help with it, especially on behalf of persecuted Christians. Dee Dee, it's always wonderful to have you with us. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me today. Always good to be here.
Thank you. Let's start with a phenomenon of the Team Biden outfit that has to do with its determination to inflict on every agency of the government of the United States, including the United States military, by the way, this agenda they call diversity, equity, inclusion. Remind us what that is and why this is an especially ill-advised agenda for the United States government.
Yeah, so diversity, equity, and inclusion, Frank, as you know, is a far-left ideology. Really, it's a Marxist, it's a Marxist ideology used to divide communities on the basis of presenting equity as some way of presenting some form of fairness. Always, American ideals have pushed for equality under the law so that the federal government is non-biased with regards to how it imposes the law on American citizens and even, you know, foreigners here in the United States and abroad. And equality under the law means that every person is treated the same. But what we've seen with the far left is that they're pushing this idea of equity. And equity says that there are some who should be favored over others with regards to how the law applies to them. And this we see that religious beliefs are often subverted to the ideologies of other groups, and including LGBTQ, I plus, whatever they want to say, subverting those religious beliefs, the traditional religious beliefs of Americans, to compel them to accept these relationships, and even how we speak about the LGBTQ community, and also to compel beliefs about abortion and pro-life groups and such to lift up one group while subverting the beliefs and opportunities even for engagement with the federal government based on those political beliefs.
You know, Dee Dee, in the case of the military, one of the things that's been particularly alarming about all of this is it's not just the LGBTQI plus whatever it is agenda. Problematic as that is, I believe, for our armed forces' morale and unit cohesion and discipline, it's also this idea that race or gender or other issues are somehow needed to be addressed through quotas, which means that promotions and, you know, placements and positions in the military are now determined not by performance and merit, but by these identities. And as you said, I think so well, this is a Marxist formula for dividing and setting people against one another and eroding, especially the kinds of things that are material to the readiness of our armed forces. So, and being enforced, by the way, as you know, Dee Dee, with government-wide effect via kind of political commissars whose job it is now to, you know, impose the DEI agenda throughout. I want to turn to another piece of this that is kind of new news, and that is that the administration is now promoting this application of DEI through foreign policy mechanisms as well. Talk a little bit about that. We're going to have to take a break in a minute, but just get us started on what's happening in this area.
Sure. On the first day of his regime, President Biden passed the executive order 13985, advancing racial equity and support for underserved communities through the federal government. And again, just in last year, in February in 2023, another executive order 14091, further advancing racial equity. And this requires every agency of the U.S. government to submit to the president their plan for pushing DEI through the agencies. And what we're going to talk about in the next section is the U.S. State Department's Equity Plan 2023 and some new rules that it wants to compel in foreign policy, especially regarding contractors and award recipients.
Okay, hold that thought. That's where we'll pick up on the other side of a very short break. Dee Dee Laugesen, Executive Director of Save the Persecuted Christians, is with us virtually. We're delighted to have her as always. You're going to want to find out more about what's happening in your name on the international scene. Stay tuned. We're back. Dee Dee Laugesen is with us. She is in our present segment speaking about one of her myriad responsibilities, namely trying to save persecuted Christians. You can learn more about our work at savethepersecutedchristians.org. And Dee Dee, you were talking a little bit about the diversity, equity, inclusion agenda now being foisted upon foreign nations using essentially the leverage of the United States with respect to funding and grant making and contractors and the like. How pernicious is this, do you think? How insidious, how corrosive of our foreign policy interests as well as, you know, our fundamental values as Americans?
Well, I think we have to see that the weaponization of DEI is taking full effect throughout the agencies of the U.S. government. And just last month, the U.S. State Department published its 2023 equity plan, in which the Department of State says that it will focus on the following strategies to advance equity globally. Five goals: to pursue diplomatic efforts to combat hate and protect inclusive democracy, to advance racial equity and justice globally, to protect the LGBTQI+ persons globally, to promote respect for international disability rights, which we can all agree is a good thing, advance gender equity and equality globally. And with that, the State Department has issued two notices of proposed rulemaking that would establish non-discrimination requirements in foreign assistance. And they've opened up until March 19th public comment on this, and Save the Persecuted Christians is making that easy for people to go and find those links to take action and submit their comments. We had Republican Senators Marco Rubio and about six others warned in a letter to Secretary Blinken on February 7th that the proposed rules would violate the rights and beliefs of faith-based partner organizations and their beneficiaries, undermine relationships with key stakeholders, and threaten U.S. security interests. And we are seeing this because, a number of especially African and Asian nations have said that the U.S. government is pushing this woke agenda onto their nations. And now through this rulemaking, it will actually tie receipt of that aid to acceptance of our non-discrimination policies. It's for both contractors and their employees, but also for the award recipients to receive that. There are options for waivers, but unlike Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which makes it illegal to discriminate in employment, this non-discrimination is not required, but it can't, the waivers can be permitted. They'll consider these issues. So it really is, what we're seeing is that the U.S. State Department, in its distraction over DEI, is lifting up these Marxist agendas and pushing them onto nations in the world in order to continue to receive that aid, and demanding, compelling them to come in line with the United States. It's a very dangerous situation, as we already have so much anti-American sentiment, and especially coming out of Africa, that we really are, offending the more conservative values of most of these countries that we engage with and seek to help.
Conservative values that I think most Americans share, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea that we're imposing on Americans this stuff is bad enough, but we're making it now the brand of the United States. And, we can argue about, which aspects of this agenda are most troubling, but I'm struck by a fact that, Didi, as you know, when we started Save the Persecuted Christians, it was with a view to doing something unique and additive to the remarkable efforts that many groups, quite a number of whom are part of our Save the Persecuted Christians coalition, by the way, are doing to relieve the suffering of Christians in countries across the planet. The feed them, to clothe them, to house them, to try to help them get, you know, legal protection, whatever it might be. There is very important work being done. But our theory had been, in setting this up with your help, we need to use leverage our government can bring to bear to try to disincentivize, to punish, to put a fine point on it, those engaged in this kind of persecution. What this DEI business, these new rules, make plain is that if the U.S. government wishes to, it has leverage that it can bring to bear, and it may have some costs, but at least if it's a worthy cause that is actually consistent with the values of our people, with our Constitution, with, you know, the basic human rights of people who are being persecuted, as I say, simply because they believe in Jesus Christ, that leverage should be brought to bear in this fashion, in this context. And we can argue about the other, but it's clear that we're not doing what is in our, I believe, both humanitarian interests, but also our national security interests on behalf of 360 million Christians across this planet. 30 seconds, quick response.
Well, we're seeing it in countries like Nigeria, where there is a genocide of Christians going on, that the U.S. government is more concerned about DEI issues in Nigeria, especially for the LGBTQ community, and it puts aside any consideration about the Christians being slaughtered in Nigeria, because they see Christianity as a majority religion and not a minority religion that should be protected. So they don't.
Yeah, and around the world, it is often in countries where Christians are very much a minority. Dee Dee Wilkinson, thank you for your great work at Save the Persecuted Christians. SaveThePersecutedChristians.org is where you can find out more about it and help us support the work. I hope you'll come back to us soon, Dee Dee, next week, and we will talk with the rest of you, I hope, next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.